Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. We have a quorum present. The first order of business would be approval of the minutes of April 12th. They are in your packets. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the minutes from April 12th, 2024.
All right. Thank you. So the minutes have been moved. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you. So first thing on the agenda today is going to be we're going to take up House File 4738, Representative Hewitt's bill. And just so members understand kind of what we're doing here, we have some of these provisions in our are going to be in our omnibus bill, but we're also going to send Representative Hewitt's bill separately to Ways and Means with the funding for the what's we're calling the pilot project or the there's another term that we're using for that, but Representative Hewitt will talk about that. Representative Hewitt, is that do you want to correct or amend anything I just explained there? Is that did I capture it okay?
You did it so well, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. With that, we have, so Representative Hewitt has some amendments. So I'm going to first move that House File 3738, the second engrossment, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And then there are some amendments that we need to adopt to get the bill in the proper shape. And so we're going to just walk through those, and we can, I think it would be best just to adopt those one by one and have Representative Hewitt just tell us what they are so everybody understands what we're doing here as we move along. So, Representative Hewitt, I don't know if there was an order in which you wanted to take these. Do you want to start with the, well, which one do you want to start
with? We can start with the A6, Madam Chair.
The A6, okay. So I will move the A6 for Representative Hewitt, and Representative Hewitt, please explain what the A6 is doing.
Again, these amendments, as you notice, we don't have a lot of white shirts in the room this time. Last time it was a little bit active. We have worked with all the groups and got them to neutral, if not supportive. These amendments are a part of their work with us to get this bill in the right position so when we can, we could do better work for the people of Minnesota through EMS. This amendment simply says that we need reports back. As you can see, and as both sides, the press conference yesterday with the Republicans are really clear, we're going to be putting money into this. We need reports back to the prospective chairs into us, and that's what this amendment is the A6.
All right, thank you. Any discussion to the A6 amendment? All right, seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A6, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The A6 is adopted. The A7 next, Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, thank you.
All right, I will move the A7 amendment. Please go ahead.
The A7, Madam Chair, is simply the appropriations for a project that we're looking at may help response times in the dire areas of Minnesota that we know response times can be up to 90 minutes. What this model does, it funds a what we call a sprint medic or a medic that's basically on patrol that will go to a certain region and basically stay there. When the tones come out, this medic would go there. They would work locally with the local volunteers in most of these places and basically make sure that we get the needs of the individuals to the scene, get the right person there to treat, and get the patient go. This is a project that we're looking at that'll come back and report so we can see if this works. This has worked around the country. We think this is our best foot forward. We are funding two of these areas. That's what this amendment does, is add the $6 million in there. It'll basically be, it's 2 years for each project. It's $3 million for each project, $1.5 million a year for the project. So, Madam Chair, that's what the amendment is.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. And we did hear this in this committee. And so we will not be carrying this in our bill because we're not going to carry the funding for it. That's going to be in this bill that's going to Ways and Means with this, and that's what this amendment is doing, is putting the money for the project with that bill and sending it separately to Ways and Means. So any discussion to that? Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hewitt. My question is everyone on board with the pilot program? Obviously, there's going to be limited funds, and $6 million is a big chunk of money to move towards a pilot program and away from what folks are doing currently. So is everyone on board with doing this as a pilot program I mean, obviously, the purpose of the pilot program is to see if these services can be delivered more effectively. But we've got limited funds going to EMS overall. And so is everybody on board understanding that they actually think that this is the way to move forward? Or is there some consternation about pulling that money for a pilot program?
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, that's a great question. Everyone is a very broad expression. I don't know who everyone is. The stakeholders all came together. Both Senator Seeberger and I both have an EMS background. I've definitely been trying to work with Representative Backer on this plan. Senator Rasmussen is totally in support of this. So we have politicians. We also have, right now in the field, people are wanting this project because it does put a full-time medic in their area, and that's we know through studies. Dr. Bielman, who of North Memorial Surgeon, has shown that if we get ALS care to a scene, we can have better outcomes, less expense if we do that. Everything points towards this. Alaska's been doing this. Some other parts of the country have been doing this. It's not new to us, really, because we used it in, like, Maplewood, Cottage Grove. It's a project that works good, especially when you have limited funds. And, yeah, you're right. We do have limited funds, but if this works, this might be the area downline that legislators want to invest in and move forward with.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. And hopefully it will be an effective way to deliver services. I'm just quite concerned. We see this in several bills traveling, that we're doing a lot of pilot programs this year. We're doing a lot of things that are not necessarily tested, not necessarily proven, in a time that we have such limited resources. So it's concerning, right? Like, we're putting money into things that we don't know for sure when we do have systems that are really struggling financially. My only other question, Madam Chair, perhaps this is for you, or perhaps Representative Hewitt, where are the supplemental aid payments going to be traveling? This is going to Ways and Means. Would this be... What target is this coming out of? Is it coming out of that EMS target, or where is this? Where are these funds coming from?
So, great question, Representative New Brindley. So, there's been a lot of discussion, and it's been kind of moving around. But there's sort of a separate line item for it. It will not be in our target. That's why we're moving this out. So, for a while, we thought the whole $16 million was going to be, and there's also a Lislegard bill that I believe is already in Ways and Means that has the other aid money. So that's why we're sending this separately to Ways and Means, and other people, not me, will be figuring out how this is all going to match together. And so there's a lot of discussion yet to be had on how all these pieces are going to fit, but they will not be in our bill.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just to Representative New Brindley's question, and thank you, Representative Hewitt, in regards with the SPRINT model, there are areas in the state that this will work well for. There are areas like in West Central Minnesota where we end up in certain parts of the Iron Range. The geographic is, there's so much geographic distance that can cause us challenges. For example, if we send out a SPRINT medic and they get there, do we have to work out, do we call the ambulance at the same time with the SPRINT medic? I know one of the ideas behind the SPRINT medic is so we can eliminate those 70% calls that are non. So there's some clunkiness with this. I know Representative Hugh and I had a conversation earlier this week. We do know that almost every single service, and I'm still working on it, has what we call no loads. If you don't turn the wheels, you don't get paid. that is a definite issue among all of us, services. I had that happen this weekend. In a 24-hour period, I had four runs. Two of the runs were no loads. So we responded to those Sunday mornings, two runs back-to-back with four patients, and they all refused care. So I am working on things, Representative New Grinley, that I think would be a better focus on non-transferred. At the same time, this does have merit in certain parts of the state. So just FYI. So, and I do appreciate you. We'll have that continued conversation, and thank you, Representative Hewitt.
All right. Well, thank you. So all in favor of adoption of the A7, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A7 is adopted. And then to the A8, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Area A8.
And I'll move the A8.
Thank you. A8 is a simple negotiation. Actually, it's a it was my error. The position of medical director is so important to EMS and its function. Paramedics and EMTs don't really have a scope of practice. It's based on what their medical director allows and what the medical director tests them and for competency on. And the medical director is so important that we wanted to make sure that we have them in the bill in a deputy position. And also, they asked that it be a licensed Minnesota physician. I feel this is a great amendment, and I hope you can adopt it.
All right. Thank you. Any discussion to the A8? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A8, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A8 is adopted. And then to the bill as amended. All right. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think actually my question would be for our fiscal staff. My question is, the bill actually has changed. It's been, I think it's, has it been engrossed twice? Has it had two engrossments? I'm wondering that we have that original fiscal note with a very low cost, $2,000, but it looks like there have been some changes that could add additional fiscal costs. Are we revisiting that? Do we think that that's irrelevant? Where are we on that?
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, so the forthcoming DE that we're about to discuss on the health budget bill carries language for the new office of EMS, yeah, and elimination of the EMSRB pursuant to the previous completed fiscal note. As this bill and its amendments are traveling separately to Ways and Means, there would be a separate discussion there to the language before that committee. So, yes, it will be tracked, and yes, it has changed. But those changes are for the Ways and Means Committee to deal with at this point.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we don't know yet what those additional, okay, great. We don't know yet what those additional costs are. Thank you.
All right. And then Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Hewitt. I'm briefly going to say overall, thank you for your passion to this issue. I know how important this is to make sure that we get this right for Minnesotans. As the granddaughter of someone from the Bloomington Rescue Squad, my parents were on the Bloomington Rescue Squad, I appreciate it. But I specifically wanted to call out one piece, and I wanted to thank you for it. Is actually, I had raised my hand and it got missed, but I want to thank you both for the pilot. You know, we're always looking for new and better ways to do things. You know, I'm an agilist at heart, and I know that there's a lot of passion around these issues. And we're always looking for those innovative approaches on how we can better serve and how to test out new ideas, right? And so the idea being that if it doesn't work, we can easily redirect, but we can actually explore some of those innovative ideas. And I appreciate that it gives us the ability to use the feedback and lessons learned to really refine that process as we move forward and decide the best way to proceed. So I really appreciate that, and I just wanted to say thank you for that piece, Representative Hewitt.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. So the chair renews the motion that House File 4738, the second engrossment as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. All right. We're now going to turn to House File 4771, which is the health budget. Did I say something else different? Okay, House File 4571, the health budget bill. And before I start here, I just want to explain to members that, as you know, we're going to do markup tomorrow. So what we want you to do is you have the bill in your folder, and you have the summary, the bill list, and you have the spreadsheets. And it would be great if you could make sure that all stays in your folder when we leave today. Unless you want to take it with you, which you certainly may, it's yours to take, but we're hoping that we won't have to reprint everything for tomorrow because it's a lot of paper, a lot of work for the staff. So just want to say that up front, and I hope I'll remember to remind you at the end of the hearing as well, just so, you know, we can do that. So the motion here, my motion will be that House File 4571 be re-referred to Ways and Means. And I'm going to move the DE2 amendment so it can be discussed, and we will discuss that today and take testimony, but we won't take any actual any formal action on it. We will lay it over at the end of this hearing so that we can take it up again tomorrow for markup. So I hope that is clear to everyone. Is there any question about that process? Okay, great. So with that, I'm moving the DE2 amendment so that it can be discussed. And so what we schedule today is to have what we usually call walkthrough and then take testimony on it. Rather than have the staff walk through the bill, you know, which usually involves just kind of reading through the bill list. The bill list has been distributed to members and is, I believe, available over there for the public and has been posted. So I'm not going to have the staff literally walk through the bill list, which takes a great deal of time. But I do want to say a few things about the DE amendment, which just for people who don't speak legislative speak means this is going to become the omnibus bill, okay? And we will take amendments to that amendment. So I just want to sort of explain a little bit about the bill. First of all, there's very little in this bill that hasn't been heard and debated in this committee. So this is a bill that four members of this committee really shouldn't have any surprises in it. There are a couple of things in the bill that are new. So when you look at the bill list, the nonpartisan staff do a great job putting together the bill list. And when you look at it, if you look down underneath, it says section, and then it has the section, which is the section of the DE, and the articles in the DE amendment. And then it tells you what the origin of those sections are. Some of them say new. And new sometimes means it came in as an amendment at some point. It wasn't an actual filed bill. And sometimes that means that it is new to this DE coming here for the first time. So what I want to point out to members is there are really only two things in here that are actually new that weren't already heard and discussed in this committee. One of those is a provision from Mike Howard, and he's going to be here to discuss it if anyone wants to do that. And that is Article 3, Sections 16 to 18, and has to do with the emergency insulin program. So that one is new. The other one is a provision that I guess it really isn't new, but it's changed enough that I want to just flag it for members and for the public. And that is in the I had moved an amendment earlier that we discussed that had in it cost sharing reductions for people who buy their insurance in the individual market. In other words, on MinSure. We know that people who buy their insurance in the individual market sometimes really struggle because even though they can afford to buy the insurance, they have out-of-pocket costs that make the insurance unaffordable to use. And so I had put forward a plan that actually didn't come from me but had been worked on last session and so on, and was actually in the so-called public option bill, had been put forward there as well to help people with that problem in the individual market. We know that's a problem. I had intended to really to bring that up and move it forward. I was unable to do that because of the cost. So in this bill, and it's in a rider to the DE, is just the beginnings of that program. What it is just to have MNsure begin to build out the technology for that so that we will have the option as a legislature to fund it next year, if we choose to do that, to help with that problem. So I just wanted to flag that for people. It is in the it's a smaller number on the spreadsheet, and we will get to the spreadsheet. Mr. Harney's going to walk through the spreadsheet because that's pretty hard to understand. But I just wanted to flag that for folks. So with the exception of those two things, there really isn't a lot in this bill that is new to this committee. But I do want to just mention a few things, and the committee will be pretty familiar with them, I think. So one of the things that this bill does that I am quite proud of is it really makes a lot of improvements to insurance coverage. I think everyone on this committee knows how I feel about insurance. I think it should go away as a way to fund health care. But in the meantime, we're stuck with it. And so we're making some improvements to have it actually cover some things that are very important for people to be able to access for health care. And one of those that I especially want to flag is the bill to cover orthotic and prosthetic devices, which actually has the most cost of any of these provisions. But it turns out that we're not covering that sufficiently in medical assistance. And when people can't get prosthetic devices that they need to be functional and to live full lives, that is a real problem. And so I feel very proud of our covering that. We're covering a number of other ones. We've all heard them in this committee. We're covering abortion care. We're covering amino acid-based formula. That was a Hicks bill. We're covering gender-affirming care, although that's been heard on the floor. We're also, it's been heard, I should say, in another bill, but we're also carrying that here. Scalp prosthetics for people who've had cancer. And Representative Hemmingson-Yeager's bill to cover whole genome sequencing. So those are all in this bill. There are also a number of provisions to improve access and make insurance more functional for people. And one of those is the prior authorization reforms. Those are in this bill. As I mentioned, the cost-sharing reduction, getting started on that. So those are some of the things that are in this bill. We're doing a lot for pharmacists and pharmacies in this bill. We heard a lot of testimony here about some of the problems that are happening. There are actually three bills that we're including here. I would say pharmacy is kind of a, I would say, sort of a big winner this year. We didn't do enough for them last year, and now we're, I hope, making up for that. We're increasing the dispensing fee. We heard about that in here in testimony. That's a Bonner bill. We're hearing another Bonner bill that expands pharmacists' authority, or actually maintains it, but also expands it to give immunizations, to do certain testing, to be paid for that. So we're including that here. That was kind of a licensing and scope of practice bill, but it had general fund costs, so we couldn't carry it in our other bill. And the same thing with we're carrying the bill that's been called PEP and PrEP, which is to allow pharmacists to cover and prescribe and administer HIV prevention drugs. So those are three pharmacy-related bills that are in here. In addition to, as I mentioned, some changes to the emergency insulin program. There are also a number of provisions in here for to help consumers, and those are provisions from Representative Ryer that are to help with medical debt, which I'm very, very happy that she's done that important work and very proud to be carrying that in this bill. Some other things from Representative Bierman having to do with oversight of HMOs, a very important hospital closure bill from Representative Smith, other work, community benefit work from Representative Bierman, and a little tweak to the 340B reporting that was my work with the Department of Health that I think will help us in the future understand better where money is flowing in our health system. Very importantly, in this bill, we have a lot of mental health provisions. Those are from Representative Fisher and some also from Representative Hicks. You heard she had a bill recently in this committee. There's a version of her bill in here where we're figuring out the rate for children's crisis services. We're not actually implementing that. As we talked about, we don't have the money to do that right now, and we don't know what that will be, but we are telling the department to figure out how to do that in the future. And then there are quite a few mental health provisions in this bill, and I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. And then another thing I'd really like to flag, we are carrying this bill, a ban on flavors in cannabis. This is the only cannabis provision we're carrying. As you all know, there's a large cannabis bill that's moving separately. For various reasons, this bill, this ban on flavored cannabis could not be carried there. We are carrying it in this bill. It just bans adding flavors to smoked cannabis is essentially what it is doing. So that is certainly not a complete run-through of what is in this bill. We can certainly take some questions when I get done here, about what's in here, and the staff are here to answer questions as well about what's in here, what version of a bill is in here, and so on. And that is all flagged in their document that you all have in front of you. I just do want to mention before we go to Mr. Harney to talk about the spreadsheet. So we have, as you all know, we started out with a very small target. In this bill, over the four-year span, we had a target of $9.5 million, which is, for the kinds of things that we have to deal with here in this committee, that's a very tiny little target. Because of various cancellations and our ability to tap some other pots of money, we're actually totally spending, or I could say repurposing, a total of $43 million in this bill, okay? Of that, about $26 million is going to mental health. So although, a lot of these provisions were given more detailed work in Representative Fisher's committee and Chair Fisher's committee, Human Services Policy, this is a really, I think all of us here on this committee recognize that mental health is a big area of need in the state. We need a lot more funding than that. This is barely scratching the surface, but we've allocated $26 million of our $43 million to that purpose. Now, I do want to say that the way that is allocated in this bill is really a work in progress. We've kind of put it in one pot because we are still waiting for a lot of fiscal notes, and we are not really able to do a more detailed allocation of funding at this time. But we wanted to really, be quite clear that we recognize that a lot more funding is needed in that area, and we welcome everyone's engagement on this because we want to be able to put this amount of money where it will do the most good for the state right now. And some of this is in the tails as well. So we have a little bit of flexibility there, but as you all know, it's very hard to do the kind of rate increases and so on that we need to do in our medical assistance program when we don't have, the costs, as you all know, are really very large, and we're not able to do that. The insurance improvements in the bill come to a total of $8 million across the 4 years. So we are putting a significant amount of money there. A lot of that is going to the orthotics and prosthetics bill. And then the pharma provisions also are at a cost of $3.5 million across the 4 years. So that's kind of my general. I keep asking Mr. Harney, I need the pie chart because I want to make sure we're sort of putting the small resources we have, that this is how we're allocating them. Just recognizing that there are a lot of needs in the state. Even though we did a lot of important work last year, there's still a lot left to do. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Harney to do some specific walking through of the spreadsheet. Mr. Harney.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, to orient you to what I will be walking through, I am going to be walking through the spreadsheet with the upper right-hand corner titled H4571DE2 with a timestamp in the lower right-hand corner of April 16th, 24 at 2:18 p.m. Chair Liebling just mentioned this ago, but beginning on line 5, you'll note the total general fund debt increase that the DE approves. This aligns in fiscal years 24 and 25 with the budget resolution adopted by the Committee on Ways and Means, and it entails the global target agreement that was agreed to with leadership for $5 million in fiscal years 26 and 27. For page 1, I'm just going to draw attention to the sum totals at the department breakout level. Line 47 is the Department of Human Services. Line 57 is the Department of Health. Line 65, while it says the health-related licensing boards, is more accurately described as the Board of Pharmacy. Line 72 is the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. Flipping to page 2, the Department of Revenue aid amount is not included in the House position on the DE, beginning on line 79. Line 105 are impacts to MNsure. Line 113 are impacts to the Department of Management and Budget. And lastly, line 121 is the Department of Commerce. Just for to be extremely clear, the bold lines on those lines I referenced are the net sum of all fund spending and not necessarily general fund spending. Those amounts are broken out below. I'm going to begin my more detailed walkthrough on page 2, beginning on line 178, with impacts to the Department of Human Services. Line 178 initiates a cancellation of appropriations made in Chapter 75 last year for the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act contingent appropriation. More specifically, these costs being canceled to the bottom line are costs that were previously contingent appropriated for the direct care and treatment department at DHS. Line 182 is a governor's only provision that is not included in the DE. This is the public option implementation plan. Line 186 shows the detailed technical mechanics of moving money from one fiscal year to the next based on appropriations made in Chapter 70. That amount nets to zero, but amounts to $3.3 million moving from one fiscal year to the next. Line 200 is a cancellation of Chapter 70 Central Office Unallocated Administrative Appropriations. If members on this committee serve on either Human Services Finance or Children and Families Finance, you've seen similar cancellations for unspent FTE dollars there. This amount shows the amount canceled in this committee's jurisdiction at the central office. That amount canceled in fiscal year 25 is $1.58 million. Flipping to page 3, line 205, this is a Representative Fisher bill related to county-administered medical assistance plans. The net total general fund impact for this bill is $272,000. Line 211, House File 3902, the Representative Bonner bill that the committee heard last Friday. This is an increase to the medical assistance dispensing fee with the total net impact of $552,000 in 24 and 25 and $1.3 million in the tails. Line 219, another Representative Bonner bill, expands the pharmacist authority to administer vaccines. The amount of cost funded to the Department of Human Services in this bill for this provision is $137,000 in fiscal years 24 and 25. And $250,000 in the tails. Line 224 is the HIV PEP prep coverage for public health programs at DHS. The total net general fund impact here is $220,000 in 26 and $268,000 in 27, with a health care access fund impact totaling $110,000 in the tails. I will note just that the DE is intended to align the commercial coverage for this provision with the public health programs coverage for this provision. Line 233 235 are no cost to public programs, health insurance mandates that the committee heard and are in the DE. Flipping to page 4, the same can be said on line 237 and 239. Line 241 are costs to the public health programs for the coverage of orthotic and prosthetic devices. The total general fund cost for this provision in the bill is $900,000 in 24 and 25 and $4.6 million in 26 and 27. And the health care access fund cost for this provision is $150,000 in 24 and 25 and $751,000 in the tails. Like the other previous mandates, the scalp hair prosthetics has no public health care program cost on line 259. Line 251, the chair mentioned this as a place where money's held for mental health, is the provision in the Representative Hicks and Fisher bills related to respite care services grants. That general fund amount for the grants is $8.1 million in 24 and 25 and $17.8 million in the tails. Line 256 is a cost for an amendment that the committee heard last Friday for a report to develop an MA benefit for children's residential mental health crisis stabilization. The total cost of this provision is $204,000 one time in fiscal year 25. The next line is 261, another amendment that the committee heard last Friday related to an update for the mental health procedures codes reports. This is a report to do that. The cost funded for this in this bill is $200,000 in fiscal years 24 and 25. And lastly, at the Department of Human Services is a governor's budget provision that the House accepts that conforms state health care programs to federal rule for DACA recipients. This net impact that you see here are savings to the Health Care Access Fund amounting to $1.8 million in 24 and 25 and $4.5 million in the tails. Madam Chair, that concludes the walkthrough of provisions at the Department of Human Services that are funded in this bill. I'll begin next on line 1506 with the Department of Health provisions. This is a governor's proposal to tether the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline fee to 12 cents. That is accepted in the House position. The House accepts another budget neutral item on line 1508 for health maintenance organization financial exams. The House accepts the governor's budget proposal in the DE for a reduction to the background studies appropriations made in Chapter 70. That amount is $2.8 million to the State Government Special Revenue Fund each fiscal year ongoing. And the next three budget neutral items in the governor's budget are accepted in the House position: the Health Professionals Clinical Training Expansion Grant Program, an update to the account for loan forgiveness repayments, and supplemental nursing services agency updates, ending on line 1519. Line 1521 is a cancellation of additional appropriations made in Chapter 70 and Chapter 75 for the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act in the 23 session. The amount of savings this provides the DE is $1.4 million in 24 and 25 and a little over $1 million in the tails. Line 1525 is a Representative Hewitt bill for natural organic reduction. The costs listed here are for the State Government Special Revenue Fund, amounting to $140,000 in 24 and 25 and $101,000 in the tails. Line 1529 is a Representative Bonner bill. This is the MDH side of the ledger for the expanded pharmacist authority to administer vaccines. These are general fund costs, and the costs funded in the DE are $381,000 in 24 and 25 and $557,000 in the tails. All of the health insurance mandates are listed under the Department of Health. This just notes that they responded to a fiscal note that had no impact to the agency, but they're yet still listed here. So that covers from lines 1533 to 1543. Line 1545 is a Representative Aiken bill for updating groundwater thermal exchange device permits. The amount here is de minimis and focused on the state government special revenue fund. Line 1551 is a Representative Bierman bill to provide more oversight for HMO transactions. The cost to the Department of Health funded in the DE is $629,000 in 24 and 25. And $1.3 million in the tails.
Line 1555 is a Representative Curran bill that the committee heard on Friday. This one's a little different in that it just shows a base adjustment to the health protection budget activity at the Department of Health for $58,000. I understand that it is the intent that the Committee on Labor and Industry covers the cost in fiscal years 24 and 25 for this provision. Line 1599 is a Representative Chair Liebling amendment that the committee heard last Friday for RFI for hospital capacity needs assessment. The amount funded at MDH is $150,000 one time. And lastly, at MDH is the Representative Smith bill requiring further notice of public hearings for hospital enclosures, and again, de minimis cost from the general fund to provide the required appropriations for the department. Madam Chair, that concludes MDH. I'm going to get into the Board of Pharmacy and other agencies listed here. Line 1734 is a governor's proposal for legal costs, for a coverage of legal costs that are borne out of the Board of Pharmacy. That amount is accepted by the House at approximately $1.5 million to the general fund. Below on 1735 and 1736, you'll just see state government special revenue fund appropriations pursuant to completed fiscal notes for the expanded pharmacist authority to administer vaccines and PEP and PrEP coverage at the board. Madam Chair, at 1772, the EMSRB here is listed. I'll note that we had just discussed this a little bit with Representative New Brindley, but the provisions included in this bill, in this DE rather, establish the Office of EMS in the state enterprise and eliminate the board. Now, the fiscal note came back with $2,000 in costs. The detail behind that is that those are costs borne by the legislature for per diems. Those costs aren't accounted for in this spreadsheet and in this bill. Moving on to MNsure on line 1802, you'll note that the governor's public option studies and planning a proposal at MNsure is now accepted in the House position. Same thing as MDH, there are a chunk of insurance mandates that just note that the department responded to fiscal notes that had no cost. And lastly, on 1812, are the costs that Chair Liebling noted are for MNsure to begin the technology and administrative requirements for a cost-sharing program the bill establishes beginning plan year 27. Line 1812 is cost for the Department of Management and Budget. The House and the governor positions both show, bleeding over to page 8, a reduction for the appropriations for Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act, amounting to $232,000 one time. I believe Representative Liebling mentioned this, that the next line below that is the insulin repayment account transfer initiated by the Commissioner of Management and Budget. This is the Representative Howard bill, or amendment rather, in the DE in Article 3. That amounts to a $50,000 transfer from the Healthcare Access Fund into the insulin repayment account beginning in fiscal year 25. Lastly, Madam Chair, the Department of Commerce begins on line 1834. The House position does not accept the governor's proposal for public option studies and planning on line 1837. On line 1838 is a cancellation of the remaining balance in the premium security plan account in fiscal year 26 of $8.8 million. Line 1852 is the gender-affirming care coverage proposal in the bill that does not require defrayal. Line 1853 is the Representative Hemmingson-Yeager bill for rapid whole genome sequencing. This amount does require defrayal, and that defrayal cost is tracked at $1.1 million in fiscal years 26 and 27. Line 1854 is a Representative Hicks amino acid-based formula bill that does not require defrayal. Line 1855, our coverage is a Representative Stevenson bill requiring coverage of abortion and related services. That amount of defrayal tracked on the spreadsheet is $500,000 in fiscal years 26 and 27. Line 1856 is the defrayal amount for the coverage of orthotic and prosthetic devices. The defrayal amount tracked on that line is $855,000 in 26 and 27. There's no required defrayal on line 1857 for the coverage of scalp hair prosthetics. And there is a amount appropriated in the base for the commerce side of the Bierman proposal to require further oversight of HMO transactions on the last line. And Madam Chair, I'll just wrap up to let members know that the mandated coverages at commerce that require defrayal are all structured as open appropriations pursuant to the Department of Commerce fiscal notes that allow for the amount necessary to fund the defrayals to be paid to those that are seeking defrayal. Madam Chair, that concludes the walkthrough of the spreadsheet.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Harney. And so I'll get to you in a second, Representative Brindley. Before I do, I just want to say that the staff here, as when we'll have a period of time now to ask questions and have a little bit of discussion before we take testimony, because the staff are going to leave and go do other work after we get done with our questions. So just so everyone knows, our deadline for amendments is 5 o'clock today. So the staff here, the nonpartisan staff, have a lot of work to do. So we're going to excuse them after we have a period of questioning and discussion. So they're here to help, you know, help answer questions with that, and then they'll go. So Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A few quick questions. Can you go over line 224 for us again? The numbers you were saying out loud, I was not, that's not what I saw on the page. I just want to make sure that I understand those numbers.
Line 224?
Yes.
Mr. Harney.
Madam Chair, these are the costs to medical assistants for providing HIV PEP and PrEP coverage. The general fund cost is 220, is total in the tails $488,000, and for the Health Care Access Fund is $110,000.
Gotcha. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just a silly process question. I don't know which of our staff would be responsible for this. It's a formatting issue. For the spreadsheet that's available online, there are quite a few. I don't know if am I a boomer or a millennial, hashtags or pound signs, one of those. There's lots of those where the numbers are obscured. So it's just a formatting issue. We can't see an accurate spreadsheet from the one that was posted online. Okay. So like I said, I don't know who would be responsible for helping us out with that. And then lastly, the very last thing you said, Mr. Harney, can you explain one more time what the open appropriation is?
Madam Chair, Representative Brindley, so the open appropriations are the – so the Department of Commerce is required to defray mandated costs that are greater than the standard benefit plan the state has. So the open appropriation allows Commerce the flexibility to pay whatever it costs. Their fiscal notes generally provide a range of estimates, and that range of estimates, an amount within that range is tracked on the spreadsheet. But the open appropriation ensures that, pursuant to the Affordable Care Act requirements, that the money's there for it to go out, basically.
Representative Dubrin.
And Madam Chair, perhaps this is for you. And while that's to the Department of Commerce, that's coming out of our targets here in health?
Yeah. Representative Brindley, if it's on our spreadsheet here, it's coming out of our target.
Excellent. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. And, you know, I think just for the public, I think it would maybe bear a little more explanation. Thank you for asking those questions, Representative Brindley, because this is really, it's sort of illustrative of how complicated our world is here in the health area, right? So under the Affordable Care Act, the Affordable Care Act required the state, all the states, to set an essential health benefit. So, you know, what should insurance cover? What must it cover? Private insurance and to be eligible to be sold on the exchange and so on. So there was some standardization. So as I understand this, and Mr. Harney might need to correct me if I misstate it in some way, but so the rule is under the Affordable Care Act that if the states want to add to those benefits, that we then have to pay for those benefits. And so that's what this defrayal is. It means that the insurance companies, when they provide this to their enrollees, can come back and get compensated for that. So they're not paying it. So when you hear that oh, this is going to drive up the cost of insurance, that really should not be true, because these benefits are being paid for by the state, or at least they're supposed to be. My understanding, though, we've done this a couple of times in the past, I think, on a couple of issues, and my understanding is that there hasn't been any defrayal actually occurring. But the money is there to do this. Now, it's a little strange because we also have been doing reinsurance, where we pay for a lot of the insurance companies' higher claims. We pay them back for money that they have to pay for claims for their enrollees. So we're kind of, in theory, paying on both ends, and that just goes back to my initial comment about insurance. So I will leave it there. Any other, Mr. Harney, is that more or less accurate?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would just note that there's two defrayals that the legislature has dealt with. One that you mentioned has, in the context of the state budget, de minimis defrayal required to date. The other was a provision in Chapter 70 requiring defrayal for biomarker testing, and as such, we're in the current plan year for the first defrayal, so I can't tell you the amount of defrayal required for that one yet.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Breyer.
Thank you,
Madam. Sorry, I've skipped to this point.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Harney, what I'm looking for then on the spreadsheet is, like, if over the last periods of time we've put money for defrayal and then we haven't had to disperse that, does that show up as something in the money not spent? Where is that reported?
Mr. Harney.
Madam Chair, so oddly enough, the first defrayal is structured as an open appropriation. That's Panda Pans. The second biomarker one was structured as a direct appropriation. So for that one, an amount would be eligible to cancel because general fund appropriations cancel at the end of the biennium. But for open appropriations, while an amount is tracked, there's nothing that you can grab to say, based on the amount accounted for in a previous budget, we're realizing the savings that didn't, for money not going out in this spreadsheet. So these are all structures that open appropriations. In the future, they would be treated as the first example of defrayal that I hopefully articulated appropriately.
I get it. Thanks. Thank you. Okay, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have two questions. The first one, Mr. Harney, is there's no line in here for a cost to public programs for prior authorizations. Is there no cost for that?
Mr. Harney.
Madam Chair, I would say for this example and also more broadly that the committee hasn't received a completed fiscal note for the prior authorization bill. And in circumstances like that, when you're facing third deadline, you are in a difficult situation to account for costs you can't know exist yet.
Okay. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nadeau.
One more, and this is in Section 22 of the bill. It's increasing the payment rate for master's level mental health practitioners. And, Madam Chair, thank you for including that in the bill. It's an important component. And what I'm interested in is how that cost will be covered and how significant that cost is.
So thank you for that question, Representative Nadeau. I actually, as I was going through this too, I actually flagged that myself because to my knowledge, we don't have a fiscal note on that yet. And I don't know if it was really our intention to leave that in or not. I guess I'd maybe see if, I don't know, does Representative Fisher want to say anything about that? No. You don't have to. That's okay. You know, it's something, again, it's one of the things we'd like to do. We have the pot of money. I mean, perhaps we should, as I said, the mental health part of this really is a work in process. And we're not even sure that that's the best place to put money. If we get a fiscal note, we'll just have to find out. You know, there's a lot of analysis that really needs to happen here. I mean, in some ways, it's harder to work with, well, it is harder often to work with a tiny bit of money where you really have to figure out where can we be most effective with this. And so, that's our challenge. You found something that I also kind of noted, the specific things in there, but we really don't have a line item for it. So Yeah, thanks for having sharp eyes on that.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and I would be, you know, one that would encourage us to do this. There, it is, it might not be the global, it's obviously not the global solution, but it does focus in those areas where I've constantly been pushing that we focus on reimbursement rates, we focus on those increases that we know are going to be effective. And does it have a, is there a little bit of a challenge with the, you know, with the phase out that we put in place last year between psychiatrists, the doctoral level people, and the master's level? Yes, there's going to be a little bit of an impact, and I'd be willing to work with anybody that I can to try to encourage that we move in this direction. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. During the presentation, I get pings from constituents and people in the public. One you already covered. The other is they were wondering why we went from 300 to 1,500, and the assumption is this is from a larger spreadsheet of where we're just putting in what is relevant to here. So I just wanted the public that might be listening and wondering about that jump, that's just because...
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, yeah, so
yeah, Mr. Harney.
You're correct. The basis of the spreadsheet is Chapter 70, which was 46 pages. This is 8 pages. That's the answer to the question, exactly. Yeah.
Thank you for responding to
the
public.
You. Thank you. I'm glad you understood the question, because I did not. So, thank you. Okay. Other questions, especially if you have questions for the staff while they're here. And so just to note, this DE is a lot smaller than what we usually have. You know, I literally was able to read the whole thing front to back. So, you know, that's sounds like it should be a no-brainer, but actually, you know, when you think about it, sometimes our bills are over 1,000 pages, and it's not easy reading. So this one comes in at 343, so that's just it's a child.
I thought it was a teenager.
So, other questions or discussion? Or are we ready to excuse the staff? It looks like we're ready to excuse the staff. So, thank you very much, nonpartisan staff, for all your hard work. I mean, they are working, I think, night and day a lot of times to get this together for us. And now they, you know, have still the challenge ahead of them of doing all the amendments. So no rest for the weary, I'm afraid. Not yet, anyway. So thank you very much. We're going to let them go. And, okay, let me find my sheet again here. Okay, thank you. Okay, so we will go to testimony then. And just... So we are going to, our normal adjournment time is noon, and we can go until 12:30, but we do have a hard stop then. So we're going to have to really keep everyone to the 2 minutes that we have advertised as what we're going to do here. So first on the list, what I'd like to do is I'm going to read ahead on the list so everybody knows, like, who's coming up next, and I'd like... the person who's on deck to also come up to the table so that we can reduce the amount of waiting time in between and have more time to actually hear from people. So first would be Katie Guthrie, and then Sarah Lopez, and then Jason Andrews. So if Katie Guthrie and Sarah Lopez can come up, and then Jason Andrews be ready, and after that, Mary Krinke, and then I'll keep letting you know who's coming up next. So welcome to the committee, and please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. I'll start my timer too. I'm Dr. Katie Guthrie, a leader with Isaiah Faith in Minnesota and a family physician who has worked in Minnesota for 45 years, first in small town rural Minnesota and then in an urban safety net clinic, providing comprehensive primary care to all and training the next generation of family physicians. I am testifying to share that I am incredibly disappointed that the proposed next steps for implementing the public option have not been included in the House Health Omnibus Bill as yet. Each year of delayed implementation costs lives. These are three real examples from my practice of people whose lives would have been radically changed had they had access to the expanded Minnesota Care public option. A 40-year-old man employed but unable to afford insurance and afraid of costs delayed care until his initially curable testicular cancer had spread widely. Despite extensive and expensive care, he died. A mother in her late 30s found a breast lump. She was undocumented and delayed getting it checked. While a state screening program covered the diagnosis of her breast cancer and emergency assistance covered her surgery, there was no coverage for the follow-up care and long-term treatment she needed. When she returned to care, she had metastatic bone cancer, which is not curable. She has young children at home. A self-employed friend of mine was only able to get insurance with an unaffordably high deductible. She delayed testing for life-threatening sleep apnea until she was in heart failure. All of these people would have been much better served, and overall cost to the system would have been much lower had they had access to the quality of insurance that would happen with the expanded Minnesota Care public option. On behalf of the uninsured and underinsured Minnesotans whose lives and livelihoods are on the line now, I implore you to implement the next steps in the expanded Minnesota Care public option in this session. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Sarah Lopez? Yeah, and I really would like the next person to come up to the table. Jason Andrews? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Lopez, and I'm Policy Director at Unidos Minnesota. Chair Liebling and members of the Hill Finance and Policy Committee, Unidos Minnesota is an immigrant-led statewide organization building power for Minnesota working families to advance social, racial, and economic justice. We speak today to express our strong support for the following provisions included in House File 4571. Medical debt relief for families, allowing people to be themselves through gender-affirming care, and abortion coverage Act. These provisions will advance dignity in healthcare for all Minnesotans across race, backgrounds, and gender, no exceptions. We're deeply concerned, however, that House File 4571 does not include further action on the Minnesota Care public option. Unidos Minnesota is a member that is Unidos Minnesota represents a membership that works in the labor-intensive occupations. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, a growing body of mortality research agreed that these individuals experienced rapid health deterioration due to the compounded effects of systemic discrimination, lack of access to care, and the risks associated with labor-intensive work. And today, 4 years after the pandemic, our members continue to experience a wide range of physical, mental, and economic hurdles, reminding us how critically important it is that we expand access to trusted, affordable public health insurance for all. Inaction decision means unnecessarily delaying completion of the analysis work needed to inform a future public option. We urge you today to continue working towards a historic healthcare expansion that tens of thousands of Minnesotans are waiting for. Please include further action on the Minnesota Care public option in File 4571, and thank you for your consideration and for all your good work.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, I guess Jason Andrews isn't here, so Mary Krinke and then Damone Presley. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. The chair has proposed legislation that includes many good provisions, particularly given the very low budget target that was set for your committee. My comments today are in order of the bill, not necessarily in order of MHA's priorities. Article 1 establishes a future cost-sharing reduction program for persons enrolled in a silver plan, raising the actuarial value to 87%. MHA is supportive of this idea, given that many low-income individuals are underinsured with insurance that relies on high deductibles and high copays, and frequently hospitals are forced to collect those copays. Article 1 also contains a new hospital surcharge on the teaching hospitals that will be used as the state's share to help leverage additional funding for graduate medical education. This was a bill of the chairs, and we are very supportive of having this included in the omnibus bill. Article 3 contains new policies for medical debt collection, and we have been working very closely with Representative Ryer and other stakeholders. We have another meeting tomorrow. We've made a lot of progress, and there are still a few items that we have a few concerns with. Article 4 contains the numerous provisions of the prior authorization bill of Representative Bonner's. With healthcare workforce shortages, we must place a higher priority on physicians' time. Prior authorizations are used too frequently and on too many procedures. We are hopeful that something can pass this year. Article 5 contains the new transparency and reporting requirements for hospital and service line closures. We've been working with Representative Smith on this language. We still have some concerns about the 182 time frame for closures. We might need to continue that work. Article 5 is a recommendation by the chairs for an evaluation of healthcare needs and care capacity. We support this baseline information that we think it's really important to know where healthcare services are located, what we have, and what the projected needs are. And finally, I just want to mention one other item in the bill, and that is Article 9, which is the mental health provisions. MHA strongly supports those provisions. We know additional funding would make that section even better. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Okay. Damone Presley, welcome to the committee. And after Damone Presley will be Michelle Benson and then Jay Belsito. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Liebling and community members. My name is Damone Presley. For over 15 and a half years, I've been free from drugs and alcohol. My calling in life is to help others experience a life free from addiction. This has brought me to Twin Cities Recovery Project to lead their commercial tobacco, nicotine, and youth cessation programs. On behalf of Minnesotans for Smoke-Free Generation, I want to thank you for including Rep. Herb's language to prohibit the sale of flavored cannabis that is burned, inhaled, or vape. We know flavors are used by the tobacco cabana industry, often one and the same, to make their products taste better and more appealing to young people. I also want to thank Chair Liebling for hearing the flavored cabanas and tobacco bills in this committee. But for all the reasons, we are glad to see that the flavored cabanas language included. We are deeply disappointed with Rep. Charles' bill to end the sale of flavored tobacco and products was left out. This committee has heard from a 13-year-old about how commercial tobacco is affecting mental health in kids. You heard from school staff who shared their students tell them that they would have never started vaping cannabis and nicotine if it hadn't been flavored. You have also heard testimony from a black pastor who quoted the NAACP saying tobacco industry is on a narrow quest for profit and they have been killing us along the way. These are just a few reasons why we can't lose sight of how critical it is to sell the end of sale of menthol and flavored commercial tobacco products. Our state should not wait another year to end the sale of commercial flavored tobacco products. Passing these policies together will ensure the legislation can fully reverse the youth tobacco epidemic, spare cannabis policy with a focus on prevention and public health, and address racial and health equities. Thank you, Chair Liebling and the committee members.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, Michelle Benson, and then Jay Belsito, and then Dan Andreessen. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members, Michelle Benson with the Health Plan Partnership of Minnesota. We appreciate this committee's work to provide an accessible, affordable, and stable healthcare ecosystem in Minnesota. We appreciate the exclusion of the public option, Madam Chair. Sometimes we have overlap in unanticipated ways. If the House does take a position, we would favor the governor's position as it includes further analysis of the cost of the public option. With prior auth, we remain concerned that Minnesota is moving forward without consideration for federal conformity. We appreciate that public programs are included and look forward to them being tracked on the spreadsheet when a fiscal note is available. We support the 2020 law being applied to public programs if there is a compromise position to be taken on prior auth. When we look at the repeal of for-profit HMOs, Madam Chair, we are opposed to that repeal. It does not improve access. It will not result in savings. It will disrupt care for those Minnesotans who are currently enrolled in the two for-profit HMO licenses. A reminder that HMOs, regardless of type, comply with the same regulations at Commerce, MDH, the federal medical loss ratio, and the state medical loss ratio. Any excess funds are returned to the payers. The Department of Human Services selected one of our for-profit HMOs to provide coverage for more than 30,000 PMAP lives. With these provisions, those enrollees would once again have to go through redetermination. Their care would be disrupted, and the continuity of care, as you know, is so important for that population. We would like to see the cost of that tracked on this spreadsheet, because redetermination for 30,000 people is not without cost. Please oppose the repeal of the for-profit HMOs. There will be less choice, increased cost, and disruption of care for those who are enrolled in PMAP and MNSHR. Moving forward, we are concerned about the cancellation of the premium subsidy account. We are facing deficits in the near future, and having funds available for flexibility in future decisions will be important. Members, we thank you for your work.
Thank you for your testimony. Jay Belsito and Dan Andreessen, and then Matt Schaefer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Hello, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. I am Jay Belsito, an organizer at Gender Justice. I'm here in support of requiring health plan coverage of gender-affirming care and the Abortion Coverage Act. Through our work to advance gender equity and secure reproductive freedom, we know the harm that barriers to access cause. We know the desperate measures people resort to when insurance providers deny them coverage for abortion care. Pawning wedding rings, forgoing grocery shopping for a month, selling their stove. These are all true stories that we've heard from people who had health insurance but were still denied abortion care they needed. They then face the prospect of absorbing unexpected out-of-pocket costs of $750 or more. That's a significant expense for anyone, and people who are insured and paying premiums are being forced to pay for that time-sensitive care on their own due to politics. If there's one thing that Minnesotans have made clear over the past couple years, it's that reproductive freedom is central to our values. In polling, Minnesotans have told us they overwhelmingly support abortion rights and also that they want abortion care to be accessible and affordable for all. Nearly 70% of Minnesotans say they want everyone in the state to have equal access to abortion, regardless of location or financial status. This legislature has responded forcefully and resoundingly. You've gone to great lengths to change our state laws and ensure that they regard abortion care, as the majority of Minnesotans do, as an essential health service. But not all insurance providers have gotten that memo. They can still choose to cover abortion care only in limited circumstances like rape and incest, or not at all. Too many of them have made that unfortunate choice. This hurts providers and it hurts people. It delays care that's often needed urgently, or it puts it entirely out of reach. It's time to clear away one more of the barriers to abortion access standing between Minnesotans and the care they need. It's time to end insurance companies' discrimination against people who need abortion care. It's time to support bodily autonomy for all by passing the Abortion Coverage Act and ensuring coverage of gender-affirming care. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Andreessen and then Matt Schaefer. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. There's a letter in your packet outlining our full comments on the bill, so I'll only focus on a couple of key provisions. First, thank you for the inclusion of the state-funded cost-sharing reductions in Article 1 as a way to help Minnesotans afford coverage in the individual market who find themselves in plans that don't match their financial situation. Understanding that there is a budgetary issue, we would request starting these reductions before 2027 because of the impacts we expect to see in 2026 with the end of reinsurance and federal ARPA subsidies. Second, the Council continues to have concerns with the significant prior authorization changes in Article 4. As I said in previous testimony, we want to address problems that occur with Council member health plans. We have told provider groups, if you come to us with specific problems, we will come back to you with specific answers and solutions. But we oppose broadly eliminating the use of PA because of the complexity and cost of health care. The testimony you heard this session was regarding concerns in the self-insured market and Medicaid. Because of federal preemption, employers in the self-insured market cannot be compelled to change their use of PA through state law. However, you can if you have concerns with Medicaid. The 2020 law established PA criteria requirements and PA approval timelines was not applied to state public programs, and the Council suggests being targeted in adopting the language in Article 4, Section 17 to address the concerns you heard from patients. Going further will have significant impacts on patient safety, and patients will pay more for their care. Lastly, regarding the coverage mandates in Article 4, we would request consideration of moving the effective dates of these mandates to 1/1/26 because health plans are already finalizing their 2025 products for Commerce and MDH to review. Some of the mandates in the bill will take some time to build into our insurance plans. The prosthetics mandate significantly changes the way that we currently cover these services, and we're working with the proponents on that language. Implementing coverage for the abortion coverage mandate will also take time, as plans will need to get creative to comply with this requirement while also not violating federal requirements prohibiting the use of federal tax credits for all abortion services. It's not accurate that this is a choice by health plans. We have to follow federal law. Developing a policy to comply with two different regulations to the satisfaction of state and federal agencies is no small task. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Matt Schaefer, and then Buck Humphrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I'm the Government Relations Director for Medica, a Minnesota-based nonprofit health plan serving 700,000 folks in our state. I want to start by answering two questions that were posed earlier with respect to cost of frail. Number one, it wouldn't be appropriate for us to ask for a cost of frail for a mandate if we're already covering the services. For our case, that's PANDAS. The second piece is those don't apply to employer-sponsor coverage, so that's one clarification. I do want to raise some concerns with respect to Article 4, Section 35. That's the Essential Community Provider Bill. And when this was heard in committee, we made the commitment to work with the hospitals that brought it forward. And first, I do want to publicly thank the representatives from those hospitals for the open dialogue. They are great representatives of their organization. Unfortunately, we were not able to reach that middle ground. We did propose a compromise of commercial reimbursement minus 15%. We understand that wasn't enough, and unfortunately, I do have to say for the record that we do think that's going to be a cost driver potentially for your members in greater Minnesota. I also want to publicly thank the committee for working to honor that commitment to extend coverage requirements to Minnesotans who are on public assistance as well as private coverage. There may be places where we already cover things. There may be places where we could be doing a better job. And what we would just ask is that if you're going to put in a consumer protection, let's do it for all Minnesotans. I don't think anyone wants to send the message that, hey, we support consumer protections as long as you're not elderly, disabled, or poor. That's not a great message. So thank you for not sending it. Last, Madam Chair, I do want to thank you. You put a lot of work into a budget every year. You put a lot of effort in, and although we might not always agree on things such as our existence, I do appreciate all the work you put into this.
Thank you for acknowledging that, Mr. Schaefer. Your personal existence, of course, I support completely. Okay, hard act to follow. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Humphrey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Buck Humphrey, and I represent the Minnesota Pharmacy Alliance. We are made up of pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, the College of Pharmacy at the U, and many, many pharmacy owners across the state. I will pick up right where Matt left off, and thank you, Chair Liebling, and all you members for listening to pharmacy. We really, really, really appreciate this omnibus bill and your Senate colleagues' omnibus bill that we testified on earlier this morning. This bill will do a number of helpful things for maintaining vital pharmacy critical services for our patients in our local communities. First, it would enact the continuation of patient immunizations and testing authorities that the federal government sought to put in place for the pandemic, and I have to say that our pharmacists did a heck of a job. It will also allow for pharmacy technicians for the first time in Minnesota to be able to vaccinate, supervised by their pharmacists, and they also did an incredible job. This bill will also open and bring access to patients seeking HIV medications for the first time. PrEP and PEP will be available at your local pharmacy, and I am here to tell you that it's 99% effective, so we really appreciate that. The bill is also improves the economic outlook for pharmacies by updating the fee-for-service reimbursement, which pharmacies across Minnesota appreciate. I'd like to draw your attention to one provision that was not included, which is Representative Bonner's 2503, coverage for health services. If pharmacists can't get reimbursed for a health service, like prescribing contraceptives, prescribing HIV medications, administering vaccines, they can't offer the service. Many of our commercial plans, especially outside the state, self-funded plans, are not recognizing pharmacists as providers, and so we need to be included in that list, just like chiropractors, APRNs, and other providers that do have their coverage under scope tied to the doctor's scope here in Minnesota law. So please, if we can get that in the conference report, that'd be great. I think it costs $27,000. Thank you for your time. Thank you again, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Heschen, and then Ann Kramer. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair and committee. Again, my name is John Heschen. I own and operate St. Paul Corner Drug, where I practiced as a community pharmacist for the past 35 years. I speak today on behalf of the remaining community pharmacies serving patients from the Canadian border to the rural farming communities of central and southern Minnesota and the neighborhood pharmacies of metropolitan areas of the state such as mine. Pharmacies like mine are an integral part of people's lives and well-being. We are healthcare providers, a large majority of you, and constituents you will see this week. We'll see us this week. We are the pillars of your communities. And as I mentioned in previous testimonies before the health committees, when a pharmacy closes, they close for good. We appreciate your listening and trying to enact meaningful legislation that's going to help pharmacies like mine and my colleagues with their staff continue to serve patients every day going forward. Pharmacists, along with help of their technicians, have proven that they can effectively impact vaccination rates, making permanent in Minnesota law the ability for pharmacists and their technicians to vaccinate patients and their children, as well as provide non-lab point-of-care tests, will make it convenient for the public to access these critical services, and it makes it very sensible public policy. We appreciate the inclusion of payment for pharmacist-provided services, such as initiation of smoking cessation, oral contraception, and prescribing authority for HIV prevention and treatment medications. However, adequate payment is necessary if we expect these authorized services to be provided. We appreciate the committee recognizing that the fee-for-service rate of dispensing need to be increased to $11.55, and this will provide more adequate reimbursement for a set of medical assistance patients, which is roughly 15% of the Medicaid population. However, under the MCO administered contracts, the other 85% of Medicaid, we will continue to lose money on a majority of those prescriptions as paid by the PBMs. It is my hope that you will enact these provisions. Conversation need to adequately reimburse healthcare providers like myself needs to be a priority next year. If it's possible for insurers to make billions of profits down the street right here in Minnesota, then there must be an economic model that takes patients and providers into account over profits. Change has to happen or pharmacies will close. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Ann Kramer and then Matthew Bergeron. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Kramer, and I'm with Nystrom & Associates. We are a certified mental health clinic here in the state, and last year we served over 40,000 Minnesotans on Medicaid. I'm here this morning to ask each and every one of you to prioritize access to mental health services in our state. And we urge you to please address the cut to mental health rates that is set to occur on January 1st of 2025. A psychiatrist that provides psychiatric services at a certified mental health clinic today receives $121 for that service. Starting on January 1st of 2025, they will receive $108 for that same service. This cut takes into consideration the 3% that was passed last session. We understand that the budget targets are really tight this year. What we're asking you is to please ensure that direct care mental health providers aren't penalized and come January 1st. We appreciate and are supportive of the language that we saw in the bill relating to the reduction of the master's level cutback for therapists. I think that goes a long way to address this issue with therapists. We remain concerned about the impact overall to psychiatry services and psych testing because they're not going to see any sort of relief from those cuts. Cutting rates at this juncture is going to have long and devastating impacts on our state. Programs will close and mental health providers will stop taking Medicaid. And what happens when direct care providers stop accepting Medicaid? individuals who need care go without getting care, and the quality of services are compromised because they don't have a lot of choice in terms of the providers that they can access for services. And how do I know this? I know this from personal experience because my family was on Medicaid, and growing up, there was an instance where we were in need of services for me, and we had to wait for the services. And finally, when we were able to find a provider who took Medicaid in another town, the experience was horrific. I mean, it was dark and dingy and a dirty place, and the provider was smoking while he was providing the service. So I share that experience because we're really concerned about what the cuts are going to do in terms of just keeping quality providers serving the Medicaid population. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Matthew Bergeron and then Susan Ilg. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Matthew Bergeron with the law firm of Larkin Hoffman, here today representing the Minnesota Alliance of Rural Addiction Treatment Programs. Just here to lift back up some testimony I provided this committee a couple of weeks ago as it related to the Department of Human Services licensing and OIG policy bill, which is included in the omnibus bill before you today. Two provisions in that. I will note we've had very good conversations. Very substantial conversations over the last couple of weeks with the Department of Human Services, but there remain two concerns, one relating to some of the changes or restrictions on the use of telehealth in substance use disorder programs. The current language would prohibit a situation where a clinician is at one site and a group receiving services are at another. While nobody thinks that's necessarily the clinical best practice by any means, for small rural providers where they maybe have small staff and are impacted by workforce issues, there are occasions in which that is a valuable tool. We did make some good progress with the Department of Human Services as related to language associated with weather being the obstacle there that could be documented. But one of the other things we've kind of pushed for in that space is some accommodation short term, you know, a handful of days, as it relates to illness or infectious disease. The idea that a provider may be ill but still able to provide services remotely, or a provider's child may be ill and they have to stay home with them and they can still do that group, particularly in a residential program where the clients are already all together. And so going forward, that's one accommodation we would like to see, particularly for rural providers. The other one is a requirement that would require licensees to provide the department notice of changes in certain personnel positions. When it was presented to the committee, it was kind of framed as a way to identify earlier on programs that maybe had gone without a key or a required personnel for a period of time, and identified that at a licensing survey at a later date. As I commented previously, we don't necessarily know that a burden on providers now would, if your intention is to operate in a violation of your license, you're not going to file a piece of paper and demonstrating your intent to do that. So that's one thing we'd look to potentially have addressed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, Susan Ilg, then Matthew, and then Matt Burdick. So welcome to the committee.
Hello, Chair Liebling and committee members. My name is Sue Ilg, and I'm a member of Democrats for an Informed Approach to Gender. I'm disappointed to see that House File 2607, which requires insurers to cover gender-affirming care, has been folded into a short session omnibus bill. Coverage of gender-affirming care is an issue that deserves its own debate and its own vote on the floor. One, because it will impact the long-term health of kids, and second, because there's so much misinformation on this topic. For example, during hearings on this issue, we were told that there are very few detransitioners. This isn't true. One of the few studies aimed at determining the number of detransitioners looked at the medical records of almost 1,000 individuals who had taken cross-sex hormones. 30% had discontinued hormone use 4 years later. That means close to 1 in 3 had detransitioned. A social media site for detransitioners created in 2017 now has 53,000 members. 17 detransitioners in the United States have filed suit against the medical providers who misdiagnosed them. An attorney who represents detransitioners told me the main obstacle to taking more cases is the 4-year statute of limitations on medical malpractice. Detransitioners begin treatments when they are immature, and often for one or more of the following reasons. There are many on the autism spectrum, many with mental health issues, many who have experienced sexual trauma and or difficulty coming to terms with same-sex attraction. It takes these kids longer than 4 years to attain the maturity and mental health needed to realize they were harmed and that it was not their fault. And I believe we're only seeing the first wave of detransitioners because the very first pediatric gender clinic only opened in 2007. As a Democrat, I thought my party would be the one that prevents further harm and helps these kids seek justice. Instead, we're denying their existence and assuring that there will be more of them. Please remove this mandate from the omnibus bill so you can give it the time, attention, and deliberation it deserves. Thank you.
Thank you. Matt Burdick and then Gail Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Matt Burdick, Director of State Government Relations of the Department of Human Services. I'm here today on behalf of Commissioner Harpstead, who sends her regrets and regards to the committee. She had a longstanding conflict and so couldn't be here today. Just really want to say thank you to the work of the chair and this committee. I know you all had a very tight budget target and are still making a lot of really important investments in our health care and our mental health system, and just really appreciate that. We, of course, appreciate the inclusion of the governor's budget recommendation to allow federally funded health care coverage for DACA recipients, and appreciate that inclusion. Thank you also for including so many of our important policy proposals in your budget. This is not often exciting work to legislate, but is really important for the people that we serve, as well as counties, providers, and really DHS staff to make sure that we have the tools we need to do this correctly. As always, we'll have some additional technical assistance and other things we want to sort through with you, but look forward to doing that as we get into conference committee. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. And Mr. Burdick, thank you to your entire staff and all the people that work so hard to get this all to happen on deadline. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. And so after Gail Larson, we'll have Cindy Vanderpool. Welcome.
Hi, Chair Liebring, and members of the Health Committee. My name is Gail Larson. I'm testifying on behalf of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. First, I want to express strong support for the many good parts of the bill. Thank you for including House File 4853, which creates new protections for HMO conversions, and House File 3539, which requires nonprofit HMOs. Our members at Unity Hospital, where services are being closed or relocated, strongly support House File 3700, which strengthens public notice requirements. We are very disappointed that this bill does not include no steps towards creating a Minnesota Care public option. Even if we cannot afford a public option this year, there are important things the legislature can do. Minnesota Care is important to me because I need better health insurance. For 13 years, I have worked as a PCA for my significant other. I had to give up an accounts receivable job with a financial services company that had good health insurance. As a PCA, my current insurance has a thick $6,000 deductible. I have diabetes, which requires medication and regular doctor visits. But more recently, I developed a knee pain, and that would shoot up and down my leg and in my back. After lots of tests and treatments, I had a knee surgery, which has helped. But now I have over $8,000 in outstanding medical bills. It feels like I'll never get caught up or get ahead. Right now, I would not qualify for Minnesota Care public option because I have employer insurance. But the state's home care programs are changing in ways that they will create the opportunity for many caregivers like me to get coverage through Minnesota Care public option. When the PCA program transitions to community first services and supports, if my clients choose the new budget model, I will work directly for them. Since each client employs just one or more, a handful of people, they won't offer health insurance. I could then be eligible for Minnesota Care public option. It would be much better than my current unaffordable employer plan or the private MinSure plans I might otherwise have to use. A public option would have lower cost sharing so I could get care when I need it without bearing the big bills. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Cindy Vanderpool, welcome.
Thank you, Chair and members. For the record, my name is Cindy Vanderpool, and together with my husband, We own and operate Pastures of Plenty Farm in Kirkhoven, Minnesota. On behalf of myself and Minnesota Farmers Union, I want to share my concern that this package does not include a next step to the Minnesota Care public option, and my sincere hope that you'll be able to address it going forward. I've been coming to St. Paul for years now to testify in support of allowing people to buy in to Minnesota Care. Each time I come with a new perspective and a renewed commitment to this work. When I first came to the Capitol, I talked about being a farmer and a small business owner and how hard it is to qualify for quality coverage that we can afford. I have shared that we are always afraid about getting hurt on the farm or getting sick, and to provide financial, that would prove to be financially devastating for our farm. And then in 2022, I shared how I did get sick. I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2021, undergoing two different surgeries and 33 rounds of radiation treatments. We were very thankful that our income had been low enough the year before to qualify for Minnesota Care. I don't know how we would have kept our farm going without Minnesota Care and all my bills. And I can say it is worth expanding Minnesota Care. Now today I am cancer free, but again, without insurance. We earned too much money last year to qualify for Minnesota Care. And looking at the plans on the individual markets, we have started to ask ourselves, does it pay to get Minnesota Care? to pay the premiums for Minnesota Care or insurance out of our pocket, or to pay just out of pocket for all my medical bills?
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
Yep. I want to be clear, we are not rich. We take home $2,400 a month for Josh and I to live off of. And that includes our house payment, our groceries, our car, and other expenses. The rest goes back into our farm. But the costs still add up. I'm on medications that cost $250 every month. And I have two doctor visits and mammograms every 6 months. And lately, we had COVID, and I had to ask my provider what I could do for it, and it cost us another $35 just to ask him a question on the app.
I do have to ask you we are way over time.
Yep,
sorry.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Okay, members, before we conclude here today, I want to remind you about keeping the bill in your folder. So if you didn't plan to take it with you, please put it back in your folder so that we don't have to make a new copy for you. Of course, if you want to take it, bring it back, you may. If you take it with you and you forget, we may have a few copies, but we just like to cut down on the extra copying. So thank you to everyone who testified today. So with that, I'm going to lay over the DE2 amendment and lay over House File 4571. So a reminder that the deadline for amendments is 5 o'clock, and we will take up the bill tomorrow and do markup. So with that, we are adjourned.